Our office in New York is called the American Indian Treaty Council Information Center, which is a mouthful. And what it is the basically started out the information and research arm of the International Indian Treaty Council.
What's the title again? American Indian Treaty Council?
Information Center. The parent organization is the International Indian Treaty Council. And we set up semi-autonomously as the information center with the tax exempt status and everything so that we could do the research and do the information for the Treaty Council that would be usable for other people, like a tribal government or something. But because we've had the only stable office in the entire organization, we've turned out to be, in the eyes of a lot of people, the headquarters of the organization, which is not a very good idea. But in practice, we've turned out to be the coordinating center for the whole organization. So the New York office role in the organization is very loose and very confused sometimes. People look to us as the headquarters of the organization, and other people look to us as the strange group up in the UN that are doing strange things and so on.
Is there a headquarters?
No, that's one of the confusions. The Treaty Council is a kind of phenomenon. We tried setting up a headquarters in Rapid City. We first tried it in Standing Rock Reservation, which was where we had our first conference, our founding conference, in 74. And the people at Standing Rock were willing to do it, and the tribal council supported the work. But the people at Pine Ridge saw it as a Standing Rock headquarters, not as an organizational headquarters. And we found out then what we should have known before, that no matter where you have it, if it's on a reservation, then the people on another reservation will see it as belonging to that reservation. And it's even more true when you're dealing with the Iroquois and the Siletz in Oregon and the Lakota and the Dakotas. Because the Iroquois Confederacy, which is very strong into the Treaty Council, kept seeing it as a Sioux organization just because there were so many active people in South Dakota. And so on and so on. People in Oklahoma did the same thing. So we decided that we wouldn't have a headquarters. The headquarters would be just the traditional chiefs of each one of those groups that are in the Treaty Council, and we would use our office as a coordinating center so that we would pretend that we were all a mass organization without the problems that we have, the communications problems, travel problems.
What is your address?
In New York, 777 United Nations Plaza. New York, 10017.
Did I miss a great deal?
No, not yet.
That's the name of the office in New York, the American Indian Treaty Council Information Center. Not the headquarters.
Yeah, I was just explaining that there is no headquarters of the organization.
Yeah, I got that one. What is the connection with the UN?
I named it wrong when I spoke to you.
Yeah, oh,
I knew I was wrong when
no
I said
connection.
It, but I couldn't think what it was. It's Native American, not United Nations.
Oh. Then maybe I should take back.
Our connection with the UN is that we have what is officially called non-governmental organization consultative status with the UN. So we're, in UN parlance, it's UN, it's NGO status. Which means that, no, that's observer status. And that's the difference between an organization status and a country status. The PLO has observer status with the idea that it would be a country someday. And we, the Treaty Council, doesn't intend to be a country at any day. So we apply for status as an organization, as an international organization. Basically, it serves the same purpose as observer status, and that it lets you in to the General Assembly and to the different committees of the UN. But it doesn't have the political power of observer status. So you're allowed to submit petitions and documents and to say things, say opinions. But the members of the UN are not, they have no reason to listen to you very much unless you've done the background work to get them on your side. Whereas if you have observer status, then of course you are going to be the PLO or Freedom or some liberation movement. So people are going to be listened to. But people that have NGO status are International Red Cross, International Commission on Jurists, AFSC, no, International Friends Network of some sort. That kind of international organization. It helps, but it's not a, basically it's a pass into the UN to get you past the UN. One of the things that status is doing for us now, and the reason I'm here to talk to Ed today, the NGO part of the UN works as a division of the UN, like the Human Rights Commission works as a division of the UN, and it has its own committees and subcommittees and so on. And
hey, Tom. Is Tom Wister, member of our board?
Hello, Jimmy. Good to meet you. The United Nations has headquarters in Geneva and headquarters in New York. New York is the show place, and Geneva is the workplace. The General Assembly meets in New York, and everything else that meets in New York is the bureaucratic stuff. Most of the work goes on in Geneva. So most of the NGO offices and committees work out of Geneva. There is an NGO Committee on Human Rights, which is headquartered by the International Commission of Jurists, which we've been working with for the past 3 years. A lot of their lawyers are our lawyers, and we've been talking back and forth and so on. So they're sympathetic with us, and they know who we are and so on. So that committee that they're the head of is a subcommittee called the Subcommittee on Racism and Decolonization, which works almost as an autonomous committee. And that subcommittee has agreed to hold a conference at the UN, in the UN in Geneva, next September, a 4-day conference on American Indians of the entire hemisphere, not just of the US. So that's the biggest thing that the NGO status is doing for us, getting it got us that kind of, because we were able to go to the meetings and so on. So we're very excited about the possibilities of the conference.
Next September.
There are a lot of problems with the conference, primarily because it's going to be in Geneva. And we have the responsibility of getting Indians from every country in the hemisphere to Geneva and the room where the conference is being held only holds 300 people. And in the U.S. and in Canada, there are literally thousands and tens of thousands of Indians who will want to go, who will want to be part of it, because everybody's been trying to get to the UN for years and years. So our biggest problem is going to be how to choose white Indians from the states. In South American countries, it's not so hard. But the Treaty Council itself, our parent organization, naturally would choose traditional leaders from our membership, chiefs and holy men and so on, which is okay, but in the first place, they wouldn't, I don't think we at this time would be able to choose six out of our entire organization, because we've got chiefs from 98 nations in the U.S., Indian Nation. And then we would be excluding other Indian organizations that are doing work, that do have expertise in fields that we don't have expertise in. So we've got to work out all of those problems. Who are the six Indians that will represent all Indians in the U.S.? It's really a hard problem.
Such an expensive place to have conferences. The Rhodesians just found out. Is there any possibility of relocating it?
The only two choices, because of the importance of having it inside the UN, are the UN in New York and the UN in Geneva. So the two headquarters of the UN. And if we had it in New York, the U.S. would not give visas to some of the South American Indian leaders, because we've tried to get them here before and the U.S. would give them visas. So that leaves it to Geneva. If we didn't have it inside the UN, we would be losing a lot of respectability and visibility that we need. And if we had it in some other country in this hemisphere, then the Indians of that country would feel very stifled, probably. And they would be stifled. If we had it in Mexico, the Mexican government would try many ways to control the Mexican Indians' input into the conference, and that's what.
Is the reason there are only six American Indians, is that representative of the total Indian population as well?
No. That's just the maximum we could have. We have, the U.S. has one full day of a four-day conference. And the room only holds 300 people. There'll be a lot of countries, a lot of international organizations, a lot of UN people. We can have, present, we can probably have about 30 people, 30 Indian people from the U.S. But they won't be able to do anything. They can participate in a workshop, but they won't be able to make any presentations. And we will probably, in fact, have about 30 people, but they will just be workshop people and just there to talk to other Indians. One of the valuable things for us is that the people that we send there will get to meet Indians from Latin American countries that they haven't met with. People that couldn't get into the U.S. or didn't have the money.
What's the Canadian quota for the Indians?
We're figuring four people from Canada.
Four from Canada.
But as yet, we don't know who those four people are going to be. Because with South America, it's easy for us to say, well, these people, and write them a letter or go down to visit them and say, be part of the conference. But in the U.S. and Canada, we have to identify all of the Canadian organizations, Indian organizations, and say, choose us four delegates. So it's a long, involved process. It's not right for us to point out four names in Canada, even though we have four people that we would like and say, these are the Canadian Indians who can come. So instead, we go to all of the organizations and say, get together with the other organizations and choose four people. So they've got the same problem we have. How in the world do you choose four people out of that many Indians that don't all have the same ideas about it?
What's the total delegation?
For the whole conference.
Yeah.
I don't think that's been worked out. We're figuring for each South American country, one or two delegates, because it's not practical for them to send it.
So it roughly worked out on the quota on the number of Indians?
It almost works out the opposite. Yeah. And I'd never thought of that. Bolivia, for example, is 98% Indian. But
Uruguay doesn't have any.
No, Uruguay. We don't have any contacts. We've got some good contacts now.
With Indians?
And we've already got the two people for Argentina.
Where are they?
I don't know. I've never been to Argentina.
The gauchos in Argentina the rough term for them, gaucho, are they Argentinian?
I think they're mostly Spanish.
Spanish, yeah.
They're mixed breeds like me or something.
Yeah.
Do you have any contact with Gertrude Long in Mexico? She is the widow of Hans Long, who started a great deal of work in them. Danish anthropologist who started working with the Mayans of the Highlands. And they established an institute.
I'm working for contact. Where is that?
Her name is Gertrude Duby, D-U-B-Y, Long.
B-L-U-M.
B-L-O-M. San Cristobal. De las Casas. Chiapas. And Harvard moved over to the Institute eventually, and then her place was too small, so the Harvard moved down the road from her. They've been working, trying to preserve the rights and the cultures of the people who were the Mayans who were driven into the Highlands, the Spaniards who remained so much intact there.
Mexico is another problem spot, because our contacts are with the Otomi, the Yaqui, and the people in the Tarascan region, just west of Mexico City. And each of them that come will speak for themselves. They won't imagine to speak for the Mayans. Or still that situation in Mexico that we've got. In Bolivia, one Indian can almost speak for the whole people of the country, even though there are cultural differences and political differences. They're not serious enough that there would be glaring contradictions. But in Mexico, it could be glaring contradictions. A Zapotec wouldn't say the same thing that an Otomi would say. So that's another place where I'm planning to go down there in next month in December.
I hope you'll go to see Shanghai. They've been planning dam projects. There are big hydroelectric power projects which would wipe out these people. Yeah. I'm very sensitive to that because I'm Allegheny Center.
Yeah. I was just going to say that parallel.
How many members are there?
We don't have a membership count. Working members, people that are active, probably about 4,000. But actual membership is impossible to count, because at the founding conference, people sent delegates, like the Iroquois Confederacy sent 6 chiefs, and at the second conference they sent 1 chief and a clan mother. So we're assuming that the Iroquois Confederacy, the traditional Confederacy, is part of the organization because they send their chiefs and their clan mothers.
Orrin and Alice?
Yeah, at the first meeting it was Irving Fallis, Leon Shenandoah, Orrin, and someone else, and Irving Fallis Jr., and somebody else that I can't remember. No, it wasn't Billy. Somebody I can't remember. And a lot of other people came. John Mohawk came. So we're loose about membership, because I doubt if the Confederacy knows what its population is, if it counted its traditional people in the Confederacy active, or if it counted all of the Iroquois people, it might be 2 different figures. So we have the same problem. We can't count membership.
You don't have a list of member nations at all?
Yeah, we've got 108 member nations. But there again is a confusion, because none of us have worked out yet, I think, or most of us have, what we mean by an Indian nation or an Indian tribe. Because the Lakota Nation has been, in the past 3 or 4 years, pushing for this nation of business and sovereignty very actively as the Lakota Nation. But at the same time, the Oglala Lakota Nation insists that it is a nation. And if it's a nation, then the Lakota Nation has to be a confederacy if they're part of it. But each of the 7 Lakota reservations comes in separate. They don't come into the Treaty Council as the Lakota Nation. And it's just that they've not yet worked out exactly what they're looking for, if they're looking for sovereign status for each of those 7 reservations or what. Which I think is not important, finally, for them to have a clear idea of. Because what we get from this whole struggle in the next 20 years will have a lot to do with the changing politics of the entire country and a lot of other things. So, we say 108 nations, but 7 of those nations are Lakota nations, which considers itself the Lakota Nation when it gets together. Of that 108, the Shuar Confederation is a member in Ecuador. Shuar Confederation in Ecuador. They spell it apostrophe S-H-U-A-R. I don't know how to spell it with an apostrophe. But they call themselves the Shuar Confederacy. And I don't know if there are a lot of nations. Mostly membership in South America is through organizations, not through tribal nations. But it is with the Shuar. And it is, or it was, with the Mapuche nation in Chile. But our contacts with the Mapuche are now exiles. We don't have any contact with Chile. But we did have, the year before we started, we had some, still had good contact in 73. So they're still counted, even though we're totally isolated.
About Peru.
Peru, the membership in Peru is individuals only. And we're talking to two campesino leagues, which are all Indian, of course, and to these individuals. But the Peruvian people are so totally unorganized as Indians that I think at this point it would be impossible for them to be together enough to come in as a group of people or two groups. Brazil is really a problem. We have one contact in Brazil, Aibaro, but we can only get to him through Funai. We have to write to Funai and say, please get us in touch with your pet Indian. So that's the way they see it, which is a very bad way.
Are you in contact with a group called Cultural Survival of Cambridge, Massachusetts? They have contact with some of the Indian groups in Brazil. They work with the... I can send you their address.
A friend of ours in was working in Paraguay, the Marandu project, is now working in Colombia and goes back and forth to Brazil for some and other places. And he's an anthropologist. He may get some contacts there for him. We work with the one Aboriginal group in Australia, but we don't think of them as Indian. We just think of them as Australian, Aboriginal.
Same for Hawaii?
Well, no, Hawaii, we haven't worked that out with Hawaii, but we work with two groups in Hawaii. But I don't know what you would call is that. That whole question is one that we're going to have to deal with in the UN pretty soon, because the UN now has a sub-commission of the Human Rights Commission, which is called the Sub-Commission for the Study of the Problems of Indigenous Peoples. And we think the concept of indigenous peoples is a crazy concept, because they don't mean indigenous peoples. They don't include Africa at all. And the Africans are indigenous. And the French are indigenous, and the Chinese are indigenous. Some of the British people are indigenous.
How about the Ainu?
We get letters from two or three Ainu. But what we're thinking about that the UN is doing inadvertently is using the concept of indigenous people as a funny kind of euphemism for something like primitive people, because we can't see what else they could be. The subcommittee, the subcommission.
The French are primitive people until the Russians, the Romans take over.
But it's the concept of dealing with this as primitive people is a pretty bankrupt concept. There's nothing you can do with it except paternalism. And that's what this UN subcommittee is doing. The head of it is the ambassador from Ecuador to Mexico. So he's not exactly a friend of the Indians. And the guy who runs it, and the guy who sits at the desk, is a German from Guatemala. So what's this guy's background? What's he like? What's his position on Indians? But they study the problems of what Jerry Wilkinson calls tribal people, which I still think is a dangerous concept, dealing with tribal people. because what does this mean? I look up tribal in the dictionary and it says primitive people with no government. No, that's not us. It looks like just another division to keep us isolated. That's what it looks like. The old concept. If they would deal with us as people who want some freedom on our own land, that's a good way to do it. Some basic human rights.
It really means people who were there before the voyages of the from the continental Europe.
Yeah, well, it should be.
Century.
It should be. But in that case, why don't they consider Africa? Why don't they consider the Breton people in France, or the French people as a whole?
The Basque.
Yeah.
Well, they're assuming that the people of those nations were, that are now ruled by those who were not native to that area. Or rather, they don't have control of their own country.
No.
The French have still control of their own country.
We are talking to this subcommittee, though, and one of the things we're talking to them about is France, because France has an Indian reservation in the Caribbean. The Carib Indians that are supposed to be all extinct have their own little island reservation just south of Guadalupe Island, that the French keep totally secret from
Asia. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of Indians in Guyana also.
Yeah.
People don't ever see because they're so far back. Are the Kuna of Fambla members?
Supposedly they are, but our contacts are in New York City. Our Kuna contacts are all in New York City. And Muriel Borst says that she's been down and taken stuff and talked to the people down there. She's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't been. It's the whole problem with South America for us is that if we haven't been to a place, we're suspect of it because we don't know. We meet contacts in the U.S. or in Europe or Mexico or Canada, and we don't know what they do back home. So we can only judge them on a personal basis. And unless we can get to their country, which we very seldom can do, then we don't know if they're telling the truth. We don't know if they're really who they say they are.
Does Muriel speak Kuna?
Don't think so. Maybe.
I've been on the San Blas Islands and was invited to sit briefly in a tribal council session, and they're all held in Kuna.
Mm-hmm.
That's the language.
That's the kind of problem we have, of all these suspicions that, mm-hmm. that our membership may be smaller in South America than we think it is.
Do you know about Carol Beerhorst's work in Guatemala? She's an American Christian who went down there and stayed for a number of years and very, very patiently waited to accept it. Story is from tribes in the area of Chimaltenango, which is northeast of Guatemala City. He eventually established a clinic there. I heard about it through some people that I know in Princeton, New Jersey, where I live. And the board of directors of the foundation are mostly people from Princeton, New Jersey. But he has set up fairly successful program in teaching tribes to take care of themselves, how to go about getting irrigation, water, that sort of thing in a country where there's a very different government. No one understands why he's being left alone by the government.
Do you know how the conferences to be sort of structured?
Yeah, it's more or less. We're still having working meetings to see how it's structured. So I've got to go to Geneva about every 2 months to these meetings. What we've got right now is that the first day is plenary session, and the next 2 days are workshops, and the last day is plenary session. And the conference breaks down into basically three areas of work. One is legal affairs, which is laws, treaties, and legal repression kinds of things. And next is economic affairs, which is land, resources, jobs, discrimination, this kind of thing. And the third is social and cultural, which is education, discrimination as far as cultural things go. One of the things we're responsible for is getting the documentation together before the conference, because the conference will, the committee will publish the results of the conference in the form of a book about that thing. So if we get people to just give speeches and we don't have the numbers and statistics of what people like to back up speeches, then people will say, well, it's a bunch of militants who are using a lot of rhetoric.
Do I remember the name correctly? Is it Richard Hoover works for you?
Mm-hmm.
He told me of a project for a videotape, was it?
Yeah.
Is that something that you would like the Indian Rights Association to know about?
Yeah, that's when, for this conference, one of the ways we're trying to solve the problem of getting Indian participation is to hold a series of conferences beginning next spring in different areas of the U.S. and Canada. And I'm going to talk to some people in Mexico about doing the same thing there, where we would have observers from the U.N., from this committee and other parts of the U.N., and get the people of those reservations in the area of the conference to just stand up and say what they would like to say to the UN committee, to the international community, and get that on videotape and edit it down, which is another problem, and present three of these tapes to the committee, say during the evening or during lunch or something, during the conference, which would be a way of making sure that we got enough Indian representation without having thousands of Indians jammed into a space for 300 people. And that started primarily from Richard, who's a white guy, who's a video tape freak, he says, a video freak. And a guy, a Comanche guy, who's one of the coordinators of our council, who is also a video freak, but he didn't have the technical know-how that Richard did. He had the interest, and he had made a few amateur tapes that he couldn't edit because he didn't know the editing end of it. So I got him to, he works in South Dakota in Minneapolis, and I got him together with Richard, who lives in New York, and said, why don't you guys get together and get a team of Indian people to do a videotape of our conference that we had last June. So they got two other Indian people in the council who had no training in video or any such thing, and made a video tape and did a what I think is really TV quality videotape. It's really good. White people think it's too long. It's 1 hour and 10 minutes. And Indian people think it's too short. So we tried to reach too big of an audience. And that was on the Yankton Reservation in South Dakota. And during the conference, the Yankton people decided to do a survival school, to start a school on their reservation. So by August, they had gotten together to do it. And they called me up, the chief out there, and said, we want your video team to come out and do a videotape of our beginning the school, the actual classes and what we have to do to have a school, and train two of our people to use the video equipment. And at that time, we wondered why they wanted their people trained to do the video work. And we learned, once we got out there, that they have video equipment. They've got shooting equipment, they've got editing equipment, they've got all this stuff. And it turns out that almost every BIA controlled reservation in the States today now has video equipment, which they don't know how to use. And they only have it because the BIA made a deal with Sony or something and put this video equipment on every reservation. And it's been sitting there for a year on every one of these reservations, and nobody knows what to do with it. So it turned out that the video thing, which we were kind of playing around with at the first conference, turns out to be a very important tool for us, because we can send the tape. It takes $20 to make a copy of the tape to any reservation, and a lot of people that didn't get to the conference can see what happened. Or people that did go, they can take the tape back to their reservation and show it to people that didn't go and say, well, this is what happened. And the people at Yankton can take the tape of their school and use it for fundraising, using it for educating people about what a survival school is and so on. So we're really excited about it now. We feel like we kind of got pulled into it accidentally. But the two people that we trained at Yankton are good, because video is not as complicated as making a film. It's very easy to do. The editing is just a matter of punching buttons. You can make a videotape for a total of $1,000. And to make a film the same length would take at least $10,000, closer to $20,000 for a film that's an hour length film. So the video thing looks good. It's like something that we can use.
And the print only costs $20 if one look over?
Well, that's what it costs us to make. To actually make it about.
Well, if I were to recommend the Indian students at Princeton University that they buy it for the library, they get it for the library, what would it cost them?
It's according to how much money we got. We sell it to Indian groups for $35, unless they don't have it. If they don't have it, they pay whatever they have. If they don't have anything, they pay it. We sell it to white groups for up to $200, because that's the going price of a one-hour video tape on the market. That's what you pay for a video tape. So libraries that have bought this video tape have bought it for $200. So if they can get Princeton Library to buy it, it's $200. If they have to buy it out of their own budget, it's $35.
I'll let you.
You're speaking in your country, so I suppose it'll be in Spanish and English.
Well, the official languages of the UN are French and English. So French. It will have to be in French, especially because it's in Geneva.
Yeah.
And it will have to be in Spanish and English.
Yeah.
So it's going to have to do all this translation.
Yeah.
That's not our worry, because the UN will provide the translation. If we get Indians from Brazil, we'll have to have some Portuguese translated. One of our contacts in Mexico is Zapotec, and he doesn't speak Spanish at all. But he's got a distant cousin who doesn't like us very much. He's willing to translate back and forth. But I don't know if he'll be willing to translate at this conference or not.
Juarez is that? Juarez.
Thanks.
How do you get your funding?
This year, we almost don't get our funding, primarily from small foundations and churches. Last year, our rent on our office was $750 a month, which is really serious. It's the prestige of being next to the UN. And we were able to raise the rent every month, plus all of our other expenses from foundations and from churches. But this year, we haven't been able to pay the rent at all. So now, this month, our rent is cut in half because we gave up half our space. But that's the first month, so we have, 9 months. Anyway, we're $8,000 or something in debt just on the rent, because we haven't been able to pay the rent this month.
Why did it go down so this year?
Well, from churches, I'm not sure. From foundations, it's really a strange phenomenon. The foundation that supported us most was the Akbar Foundation.
Was it new last year? Was your organization new last year?
Started in 74. But what the board of directors of Akbar told us this year was that we were being too effective, and that we had gotten the UN to give us a conference, we were getting NGO status, we were doing all these things, which they thought that we were dumb Indians, we couldn't do it.